want to thank everyone for coming out tonight who did, making an effort to do so, as well as I'd like to thank Brother Adonis for considering me in his prayer, praying for me, helped me to learn this difficult, to me anyway, but an all-important business of learning how to preach the gospel, being in season, being ready in season or out of season, and I only get that way by practicing, so I thank you for letting me do that. One of the hardest parts to me of planning a sermon is trying to figure out what I want to talk about. What's a subject that's both interesting but useful as well as being accurate? I've kind of learned through the years how to do research reports and things like that, so I could probably scramble some facts up for you and present them in a clear and concise way, but I always do better if I can find some kind of personal or emotional connection to the subject that I'm talking about. And tonight's lesson came from, I guess, a series of personal gripes that I have. So I'm going to start off by sharing with you some things that bug me. And after I'm finished listing this small laundry list, we'll talk about the common connection they have, which will be our subject tonight. First thing I want to mention that bugs me is the fact that within just the past few years, we had a president, the single most powerful man in authority or individual in authority in our country, caught chasing his intern around his office while on the job at work, lying about it and only admitting to it when he was pressed with irrefutable evidence that was going to happen. That bugs me. Second thing that bugs me is the fact that more recently, larger companies such as Enron and WorldCom had their chief executive officers cooking the books a little bit to their own personal gain, trying to kick the value of those stock options up, with the result being the entire economy is undermined by it, which means all our jobs, all our paychecks, and all the poor people working for those people. And that bugs me. Closer to home, just a few years ago here in Beaver Creek, the school system came up a couple $1 million short in their budget because they accidentally overspent, and guess who got to pick up the tab for that? Well, me and the rest of the citizens of Beaver Creek, and that kind of bugs me. And finally, more close to home is the fact that the company I work for now, it's a fairly large software development company, and I've been there coming on 5 years in November. In that time, in the 5 years I've been there nearly, I've had 5 bosses and 3 titles. And I've had one coworker of mine who said they've had 7 bosses and 4 titles in the past 3 years, and that kind of bugs me too, because when it comes down to it here, of course, as the business cycle changes, it's time now for budget cuts, which means people cuts, which means guess who's deciding who gets cut? And it's the people who kind of decided that I needed 5 different bosses and 3 different titles in 5 years. Well, all these things bug me, and I'm sure each of you can relate to have things that bug you of a similar nature. But the one thing that all of this laundry list that I'm giving you has in common is a problem that affects us all, and that is the idea of mismanagement. Of course, it shouldn't be maybe too much of a surprise that the world would be so filled with mismanagement, if it is indeed apart from godly principles, which it often is, and people doing what's right in their own sight, they're going to evolve to chaos and from mismanagement, not understanding how to live in a godly way, in a self-sacrificing way, in a right way. However, the fact that it's pervasive throughout our entire society, and the laundry list that I just gave you, I think, is a sample of all parts of our society, is more alarming to me, because it means that it's so pervasive because there's some source that's touching everything. And when it starts touching our homes and schools, and most importantly our churches, then it becomes a serious problem. And to prevent that, I think it's worthwhile looking at ourselves as Christians, and in particular the importance of management, managing our lives, and managing ourselves for God, working the mismanagement out and the chaos that ensues and might be the problem, the cause of so many of the problems that we have to deal with. Before starting into the scriptures, though, I wanted to take a look at, let's understand what management is before we actually look at it and how we apply it to our lives as Christians. First, I want to credit and thank Brian Blackaby. He's responsible for the fine illustration that you see up here. Part of his little portfolio during graduation, I noticed some excellent artwork, and I decided I'd commission him to help me out give me a nice little visual, and I think he's done an excellent job in illustrating it. Something else I wanted to point out is I didn't give him the details. All I said was, Brian, I want you to draw me a picture that illustrates the concept of management, and that's all I did. And you see, he did an excellent job of incorporating those elements in his artwork. Notice, for example, first of all, four main areas that kind of comprise management, and it kind of tips it off. I've got family, work, money, and time, and the four of those obviously show an orientation towards personal management, which is exactly what I wanted to look at today. Something else you'll also notice is this is what we manage is constructed in the context of a scale, a balancing scale. Notice a very, very tight pendulum point up here for which the balance swings, which means physically that it depends on all of these buckets that he's illustrated here on being perfectly balanced to keep that scale upright and functioning. If any one of these buckets gets out of whack or oversized or undersized, as the case may be, the scale is going to fall. And if this, we think about this as our lives, when those get out of balance, our lives are going to crumble and fall as well. So the important point being from the illustration, the way we keep these buckets balanced, which is important to keeping the scale working right, is by the concept of management. We manage each of these things and keep our scales in balance. With that, if you're in the audience tonight, whether you're a Christian or not, it's important to note that God expects all of us to manage our lives. And we'll see that if you'll turn to the 25th chapter of Matthew. I'm going to start reading a parable of the talents from verses 14 through 30. Please read along with me. For it, and the it it's talking about in verse 14, if you look at the context, the beginning of chapter 25, the it refers to the kingdom of heaven. So it's saying, for the kingdom of heaven, it's just like a man about to go on a journey who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. To one he gave five talents, to another two, and to another one, each according to his own ability. And he went on a journey. Immediately, the one who had received the five talents went and traded with them and gained five more talents. In the same manner, the one who had received the two talents gained two more. But he who received the one talent went away and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. The one who had received the five talents came up and brought five more, saying, Master, you entrusted five talents to me. See, I've gained five more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful in a few things, and I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. Also, the one who had received the two talents came up and said, Master, you entrusted two talents to me. See, I've gained two more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I'm going to put you in charge of many more. Enter into the joy of your master. And the one also who had received the one talent came up and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid and I went away and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what's yours. But his master answered and said to him, You wicked, lazy slave, you knew that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on my arrival I'd have received it back with interest. Therefore take away the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. Throw out the worthless slave into outer darkness, in the place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. In this parable that we just read, there's several observations we can make. First of all, the fact that each of these slaves, or other translations call them stewards, steward given something of value that they don't own, but they possess with an expectation of managing it. They were entrusted possessions. They were given objects of value to be used. And they were given different talents. However different the talents were, though, they were based on the ability of the individual. And that means that the individual had the ability to use what they were given. Next, you'll notice the slaves who were improved in what they did, the stewards who did a good job, went into action to take what they had been given and grow it. It did it immediately. Where, on the other hand, the slave who didn't do what he was supposed to do neglected and stored the talent that he'd been given. even though they were given different talents and had different results based on the way they managed or mismanaged, all were equally accountable for what they did with the talents, as they were all called to account for them by the master when he returned. So the conclusion we can see from these observations is that success came from managing these talents, and failure resulted from not managing them. Some other conclusions we can draw from this is the fact that the talents were given, each one according to their ability, which means that the master knew them well enough to know that what he gave them, they were able to do something with. It wasn't a matter of they have something, they don't know what to do or how to do with it. It was given according to their ability. They knew what to do. Secondly, the talents were given with expectation that they would be grown by the actions and efforts of the stewards. They were going to do something. They just weren't given it. There was an expectation. They knew it, and it happened. When he came back, they had to account relative to that expectation. Also, the talent investments results were accounted for definitely. They knew it. It said even though he was gone a long time, you know, in a long time, it'd be real easy to say, well, I'll start tomorrow and I'll work on that. I'll start tomorrow and manage it. Maybe next week. But after a time, there's a time when time runs out, and that time came for the steward with the one talent. And finally, and maybe most importantly, and impressed in our minds the importance of talents and managing talents for God, is the fact that there are definite and inescapable consequences as far as God's concerned about mismanaging what he gives us. First of all, the loss of a talent. You know, a talent is something of value. It's something not only, even if it belongs to someone else, it's still something of value that the holder or the manager can benefit from. So it's a loss of something of value, something of benefit. There's also something of a personal disgrace, the fact that not only did the unfaithful steward lose his talent, but it was given to one of his peers who'd managed better. That leads also to a condition of a degradation of self-worth, if you will. Your peer got it because you just didn't quite cut the mustard, because you didn't even try, knowing full well what you needed to do. And it gets worse. There's punitive damages. As this unfaithful steward was considered worthless, as it says in verse 30, and he would be thrown into outer darkness, as it says, in the place where there would be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And finally, it was just the wrong thing to do. He was a steward. That was his job. He knew it. He knew what he was supposed to be doing with the money. He knew how to do what he was supposed to be doing with the money. At the very least, he could have minimally satisfied his master by taking the money and drop it in an interest account at the bank. I mean, how hard is that to do? That's just the wrong thing to do, to take it and neglect it when that's your job. You know it, your master knows it, and you go and do it anyway. It's the wrong thing to do. So after observing this parable, one thing that we should all conclude and be impressed with is the fact that it's important that we understand, number one, we all have talents. And I've heard this lesson before when sometimes it's talked about a specific talent. Take Brian's artwork, for example. I can't draw like this, but some can, and that's a definite talent. I was able to use it with his help and cooperation tonight in attempting to communicate my message. However, I think everyone, in addition to having different talents like that can be used, there's one talent we all have in common that's extremely valuable to God and to his work, and that is he's given us a life and an ability to make an impact and a free choice to do so. Everyone in this room has that talent, and we're all expected to use it by God to do his work and further his purposes, in particular, the saving of souls from this world in the day of judgment that will be coming soon. And God has the expectation that we'll do take those talents and grow them and do something with them in that manner. Think about it in our maybe something we can relate to in our own lives. I imagine most of you, if not all of you, have retirement accounts. I have one, and it's called a 401k method. And I contribute out of my net income, out of my paychecks, and I do it for an important reason. You know, I could really use that money, especially with my 2 4-year-old twins and one on the way. I could really use that extra money, but I take the time to put it away because I'm going to need it for an important reason. I give it to a financial institution that I trust to manage that money for my benefit. These people that I give this money to have stated that that's their job. They know how to do it, and so I expect them to manage it with honesty, integrity, and to put their best into it. And this is so important to me because I'm putting this money away, as most of us do, because there's one day when I'm not going to be able to work because of age or other reasons. So it's real important that that money's there when that day comes. And I don't know about you, these past few years, I get a little accounting every quarter, I think, about how those investments are doing. And I'll tell you, here the past few years, I see these big thousand negatives in the thousands of dollars. It has an effect on me, and I think if you've seen them, it has an effect on you too, for a very good reason. As a matter of fact, if those accountings aren't quite good, we usually will make a change because of poor results, or in the case of Enron and WorldCom and some of these other companies, we'll even to the point of legal action because of the mismanagement. So we look at that example, we can understand the importance of managing the most important asset we have, and that's our lives and the free choice we have to live it towards God. And the fact that He has an expectation that we'll do so. And we will account for that one day, as is clearly illustrated in the parable of the talents. Well, this being so important, and mismanagement being so widespread, I've got to admit, I've looked all my life trying to learn how to manage more and better, and I'm not finding it at work, I can tell you that, and I don't always find it at civil organizations. So, since we're accountable for God to what we do with our lives, perhaps it's best to look at God and what His method is for teaching management. And the first place to look at that is, how about those who manage God's house, known as elders or bishops or generically overseers? Let's look at the qualifications of those as given in 1 Timothy chapter 3. Let's see if we can glean some insight as to how we learn to be good managers of the assets God's given us. Yeah, 1 Timothy chapter 3 from verse 1. It's a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it's a fine work he desires to do. An overseer then must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, but gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? And not a new convert so that he will not become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. And he must have a good reputation with those outside the church so that he will not fall into reproach in the snare of the devil. It's a fairly long and comprehensive and specific and detailed list here. Some things that go in to make what God considers a good manager to entrust his household to. But one in particular, we could talk about all of them, but the one I want to focus in on is from verse 4 and 5. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. Because if a man doesn't know how to manage his own household, how will he be able to take care of the church of God? So that suggests to me the first place that we learn how to manage and the way God would have us, which, you know, if it works for God's house, it should work for anything that we put our hand to, is in our own families and our family relationships. The Bible talks more about that, and we can see what we can glean from that by looking at Ephesians chapter 6, a few short verses there regarding the family. The first family relationship to look at that we can learn management from is that of being a child in a family. Ephesians chapter 6, reading verses 1 through 3. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. First thing, obedience to parents. That's going to give us some skills if we practice it. It's going to teach us things like authority. There is a parent figure, and that parent has authority. It's going to teach us what it is. It's going to teach us about communication, understanding who our parents are and what they expect of us, and how we can accomplish those things. And finally, it teaches us to deal with expectation. If our parents have expectations, we learn how to fulfill those expectations, then we learn how to be disciplined, self-controlled, and we learn about service and what it is to be a servant and how to accomplish things. This results in us learning about accomplishment and a very important segment of how to manage by learning all these things through our obedience to parents in a family environment. Secondly, though, in addition to being children, we can learn it from being parents, even as the verse about elders we just read suggests. Continuing on in verse 4 of Ephesians 6. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Not provoke children to anger. Maybe the best way to do that is by maybe understanding the child and learning how to communicate what it is that they need to do and being self-controlled and patient enough to guide them and ensure that they learn these things so they can learn those skills and they can learn to be good managers. Mentions about bringing them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Another important part of managing our lives as Christians is being able to, first of all, understand God's vision. In other words, what He put us here to do as families and as fathers and as Christians. Not only understanding it, but once understanding it, communicating that vision to our children through consistent example, actions, and teaching. And by teaching these skills necessary to accomplish God's vision in our children, and by recognizing when correction is needed and providing it, we learn how to manage. And I'll tell you, being a new parent myself, it doesn't come easy and it doesn't come quick, but it does come. You learn things about management principles by managing children. However, an important point is just the fact that you have children doesn't mean that you're going to be a good manager. Because even though the potential's there, we as managers have to put the time into it to manage, to learn it, to do it, even at the cost of our own personal things that we want to do. And finally, within the family, Ephesians 5, backing up a chapter from verses 25 through 28, we learn about management by being good spouses and understanding the role, our role as a spouse. From verse 25 of chapter 5, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands ought to also love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. And it's true whether you're the wife or the husband. The idea is giving up your own plans and ambitions and giving up your own self, sacrificing it for the good of the unit, for the good of the family, for the good of the spouse, to make sure that the job gets done, to make sure that God's vision of how, what we're supposed to be and how we're supposed to be gets done. By learning how to do that, that's an important part of how we learn how to manage. Well, we've talked about the importance of personal management as people of God and why it's important and the expectations God has for it. We've talked a little bit about some ways we can learn, some principles, how we can learn how to do that and do it effectively and be pleasing in God's sight with it. The final area I want to look at tonight is a comprehensive example of a man who illustrates and shows us how that's done in a very effective way. The man's name is Nehemiah, and if you want to turn to Nehemiah, the first chapter, I'm going to be reading a series of scriptures describing how Nehemiah managed in a very important time. A little background on Nehemiah for those of you who might know who he is, might not know who he is. It's a time when God's people under the Old Testament, the Jews, were taken into captivity by foreign powers because of a broad infestation of sin that was throughout, permeated their entire culture and life. And God brought them under subject to some other world powers to kind of straighten that out. At the end of it, though, true to his promise, he brought them back to Jerusalem. But what they found when that remnant returned was a destroyed place, despotism, and they desperately needed something to get them back on their feet. They needed leadership, they needed management to make it happen. And Nehemiah ends up being the man to provide that. Let's start with introduction, chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital, that Hanani, one of my brothers, and some men from Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. They said to me, the remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach, and the wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. When I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. First thing we noticed was is the situation, the plight of the Jews was very, very important to Nehemiah. And for us to be manage effectively, we have to be motivated by understanding the importance of what we need to manage. Secondly, he wanted to know. It's something that'd be real easy to stick your head in the sand because of how terrible it could be and all the work that it would take to bring it back. He didn't do this. He wanted to know what was going on. And finally, once he found out what was going on, it was obvious he had to act. But you notice he started his management process. His first act was to include God by praying to him directly to talk about it. Let's move down to verse 11, the second part. We're going to read through chapter 2 to see how Nehemiah acted. Now I was the cupbearer to the king, and it came about in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence, so the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, though you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart." Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, "Let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate, and its gates have been consumed by fire?" Then the king said to me, "What would you request?" So I prayed to the God of heaven. I said to the king, "If it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it." Then the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, "How long will your journey be, and when will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. I said to the king, "If it please the king, let letters be given me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river. They may allow me to pass through it till I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house which I will go." And the king granted them to me because of the good hand of God, of my God, was on me. Now Nehemiah was a cupbearer, and I looked that up in the dictionary. And what a cupbearer is, it's basically a servant who pours the king's drinks. Okay, doesn't necessarily take rocket science to be able to do that. And I'd say it's pretty sure that he didn't have an MBA, and he didn't need one to be a good manager, as we're seeing and will continue to see. However, one thing about the cupbearer was he was a very trusted individual with a king, and he had to be. Because a lot of people wanted to bump kings off. That's how they moved up. And what faster way than to have the cupbearer poison what he was drinking? So the point is it didn't take an MBA to be a good manager, but it did take an incredible character. And Nehemiah had it. It's evidenced by the king's treatment towards him, and it's going to be further evidenced as we see how he behaves further on down. Notice he continues to include God in all his actions, even at this point when approaching the king. So we get on down to verse 11 in chapter 2, and we're going to see what happens when Nehemiah reaches Jerusalem. From verse 11 through 16. "So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days, and I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I didn't tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me except the animal I was riding on. So I went out at night by the valley gate in the direction of the dragon's well and on to the refuse gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall. Then I entered the valley gate again and returned. The officials did not know where I'd gone or what I'd done, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work." Nehemiah realized that in order to manage this project, he had to have a full, complete, comprehensive knowledge of what was going on. So instead of relying on others, sitting as a figurehead, sitting as a martinet giving orders, he rolls up his sleeves, gets on his donkey, and goes out and looks at the wall by himself. He gets active. He finds out what the situation is. And once he knows specifically what it is, we see how he executes the plan to bring it back. Dropping down to verse 17. "Then I said to them, 'You see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates are burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach.' I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. Then they said, 'Let us arise and build.' So they put their hands to the good work." Notice in executing as a manager and leader of these people, Nehemiah, first of all, is very realistic. He doesn't sugarcoat it. He doesn't say what they need to hear to motivate him. He tells them exactly what the situation is. He's seen it for himself, and he honestly communicates that to the people that have a stake in all this. Very strong trait of leadership, essential to any management that we do. And notice the involvement of God's continued as he explains that God's involved in this. Now in chapter 3, it talks about the actual building. I'm just going to read the first three verses to get a flavor of how this action went about. Verse 3 of chapter 1. Then Eliashib, the high priest, arose with his brothers and the priests and built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and hung its doors. They consecrated the wall to the Tower of the Hundred and the Tower of Hananel. Next to him, the men of Jericho built, and next to them, Zakur, the son of Imri, built. Now the sons of Hasanah built the fish gate. They laid its beams and hung its doors with its bolts and bars. And on and on and on. It describes kind of going down the wall, these different people and different groups that were working on it. I want you to notice, if you read the entire third chapter, you'll notice that Nehemiah managed successfully a diverse group of people with diverse talents. There was high priests in their family, men of Jericho, various individuals mentioned, Gibeonites, officials in their families, Levites, temple servants, goldsmiths, merchants. He managed them all. And finally, through persistence and adversity in chapter 6, we find that he accomplishes the job with a job well done and successful. Chapter 6 and verse 15. So the wall was completed on the 25th of the month in 52 days. When all our enemies heard it and all the nations surrounding us saw it, they lost their confidence, for they recognized this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. And there's a lot more in chapter 1 through 6 that I didn't cover because of time. But Nehemiah shows us, you know, God's expectation for us to use the talents that he gives us, to use our lives and his work, to recognize what's important and what needs to be done, make a plan, involve God, and then roll up your sleeves and get up and get out and do it. And it's as simple as that. And that is the lesson tonight. If you're in our audience tonight and you're not a Christian, I can't impress enough one of the important things we learned tonight, if nothing else, from the parable of the talents, is the fact that whether you're a Christian or not, God has an expectation of you that you're going to find out what he wants you to do. You're going to make a plan. You're going to involve him, and you're going to do it. If you're in our audience tonight and you're not a Christian, he asked you to become one. After hearing his word and researching it and coming to believing it, making a decision to change and repent from the life different from what he tells you, confessing Jesus as his son and believing in what he did, and finally being baptized, a complete immersion in water symbolizing Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, thus completing the covenant with God, becoming baptized into Christ, forming a covenant relationship with him. That's your first task tonight if you're not a Christian. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to manage that? If you're unsure about something, you're going to clarify it? You're going to keep going until you make the decision to get up and move on it? Or are you going to be like the steward with the one talent? You're going to put that idea on the back burner. You're going to shove it in the ground, not going to do anything with it. Just wait. After all, who knows when God's going to return? And it is a long journey, but the fact is, he will return. You will account, and you will be rewarded accordingly. It's clear, crystal clear. There's no escaping it. It will happen. If you're in our audience tonight, if there's any way we can assist you in making that decision to manage your life for God, we invite you to come forward now as together we stand and sing.